And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
There was a time, billions and billions of years ago, when there was no planet Earth. The universe was a swirl with stars and planets. Then there was an Earth, locked in orbit around the Sun, itself just a small player in the majesty of the Milky Way. And then there was life, bipods and trilobites, sponges and more. And then, well, the story goes on. But so does the debate as to what was behind all of this. Today, we're heading into the realms of evolution and the war with intelligent design. When your voice of the Earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News, and now, Sydney Wildsmith.
It's a topsy-turvy world in many ways. As American troops battle to bring the right for Iraqi citizens to believe whatever religion they want, or no religion at all, in the name of democracy, here at home, a war is raging that is forcing religion into what was supposed to be sacrosanct, not only the grand halls of science, but the halls and science classrooms of our public schools. The push for inclusion of intelligent design in biology classes is causing quite a debate. Kansas just passed a law requiring intelligent design to be conjectured in their public schools. What's your take on this? Today, I've brought in someone uniquely qualified to have an opinion. Wendy Holtkamp is an evolutionary biologist, and she is a Christian. How does she see this debate? We'll find out after the news. She'll continue into our second segment, then we're up to the far northwest to learn about the North Cascades Institute, where you can go to learn about butterflies and eagles doing fieldwork, bring your family to a beautiful new lodge in the High Cascades with breathtaking views, and even get a master's degree in nature education. It's all coming up on this late 2005 edition of the Wild Side News. So put an extra log into your wood stove, pour up a fresh refill of Java, settle back, and take another audio adventure into the wonders of the realm. And so, the news. The mysteries of nature are endless. One that has baffled scientists for many years is that most unusual protuberance on a narwhal's head that can often reach 8 feet and more in length. The long tusk, which is much like a giant tooth, was hard to explain. However, Harvard School of Dental Medicine researcher Dr. Martin Nguia reported that his team discovered that the narwhal's tusk is filled with millions of nerves, which reach the surface and create an extremely sensitive appendage. It is speculated that, therefore, the narwhal would use such for discriminating a variety of oceanic conditions, including temperature, salinity, contaminants, and more. It also may explain the narwhal male's habit of rubbing tusks, which would generate quite a sensation, literally. The narwhal are among the rarest of whales, reaching 13 to 15 feet in length, and found mostly in the Arctic Ocean waters of Canada, but as far east as Russia. Good news for planet Earth. Remember the shadow that covered California's Million Solar Roof Initiative and killed it? Well, the sun is shining again, as state energy regulators on Tuesday unveiled what could be the nation's most ambitious program to expand solar power, proposing to offer more than $3 billion in consumer rebates over the next decade. The plan is essentially the same as Governor Schwarzenegger had proposed, which provides rebates to homes, businesses, farms, schools, and other public buildings that install rooftop solar panels. Bernadette Del Chiaro, clean energy advocate for Environment California, declared that with rising energy prices and continued air pollution, this is exactly the kind of landmark initiative California needs. From this, we're going to see cleaner air, affordable solar energy, and California regaining its leadership in solar power. This puts California on the fast track to catch up and even surpass Germany and Japan as the world's leading solar-powered region. Maybe this time, it will actually succeed. And in Washington, House Republicans have dropped a provision in budget legislation that would have allowed the sale of public lands for mining. Many Western senators had criticized that provision, which would have overturned an 11-year-old congressional ban that prevents mining companies from buying public land at cheap prices if the land contains mineral deposits. Nevada Representative Jim Gibbons, author of the mining legislation, revised the provision Monday in an attempt to gain Western support. The new version dropped language that would have allowed the direct sale of some lands that no longer contained minerals. However, on Tuesday, Gibbons said it was clear that even the revised provision would not make it through the Senate, where some senators had threatened to use parliamentary maneuvers to block it. Score one big one for our side. But don't get too elated. Meanwhile, the U.S. Forest Service Tuesday proposed rules to allow certain small oil and natural gas drilling projects in national forests and grasslands without requiring lengthy environmental reviews. The policy change would speed approval of drilling permits on federal leases, bringing oil and gas to market more quickly. But the legislation would also result in road cuts, drilling rigs, and pipelines in areas still being protected by environmental protections. Under the proposed rules, an energy company's exploration plan would be excluded from the normal environmental review process as long as the project did not involve more than 1 mile of new road construction or road reconstruction, 3 miles of new pipeline, or exceed 4 drill sites. Comments are being taken via email at, okay, get ready, this is a long one, ogcotex@contentanalysisgroup.com. Let's try again. ogcotex@contentanalysisgroup.com. Let's try from the start here and spell it. ogcotex@contentanalysisgroup.com. One long word. And that's the news. So now, evolution and intelligent design. I'm always looking around for interesting stories, and I came across one recently. And having lived in New Mexico for 25 years around the Santa Fe area, one of my absolute favorite places, filled with power and mystery and majesty and wonder, is an area outside of Santa Fe called Abiquiu, which is where the legendary artist Georgia O'Keeffe lived and painted. What attracted me was a story of a woman who happens to be a biologist and is at this point working on her PhD, who decided to go kind of head off into a very rustic situation out on that area and write about it, because she also is a nature writer. And her name is Wendy Holtkamp, and she's joining us now from her home in Houston. Wendy, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
You grew up, you had a unique opportunity growing up in Oregon to be raised in a very rustic situation. And I'd like to explore that to some extent to give people a sense of how it is that you came to this relationship with nature.
My dad grew up in Los Angeles, and he decided to, you know, it was time, it was the early 70s, and he wanted to just take off and start, you know, to give the kids, his, you know, I have a brother, to give us something different than he thought the city could offer. So he went off in search of some land, bought 24 acres of land in the forest in Oregon, built his own log cabin, and we lived there with no running water, we had kerosene lanterns, we heated the water on the wood stove, showered from a bucket, raised our own food, chickens and vegetables, and so it really, it was a great childhood. It really, you know, I ran around and my toys were tree knots and playing with Tonka trucks in the dirt. So sort of a different lifestyle than somebody, you know, who maybe grew up more in the city. So,
well, 70s is a pretty contemporary era. So to what degree were you aware that you were living this very unique lifestyle?
That's a good question. I don't think I really thought twice about it because, you know, that was just the way it was. And my parents were divorced, so my mom lived in a, you know, an apartment complex, and I kind of split time between the two of them. At one point, my dad won custody of me, and I actually went and lived with him full time for a while. And, you know, I think as a child, you don't really ponder, at least I didn't that much. That was just the way it was, and I loved it. I loved, you know, running around outside and playing in the garden and picking huckleberries, and that definitely, as I, later in life, I went back and lived with my mom in suburbia, and then I kind of got into that whole culture in high school, and it wasn't until when I was in college, I went to Australia to study rainforest ecology, that I kind of came back to my roots, and I saw, wow, this is really what I love. I need to be more in tune with nature again. So it was kind of a coming back to what I knew from my youth. So,
right. You, however, have integrated fairly fully into the realms of urban living. You've also been going to school for quite a bit. You have a master's degree in wildlife biology or ecology, and as well evolutionary biology. Mm-hmm. And now you're working on your PhD.
Yep.
And we're going to talk about a book that you have coming up that's going to address some of the issues. You like, the name of the book is called Fish Wars.
Right.
And this really starts to address some of the issues that are so prevalent right now concerning evolution and intelligent design. But before we get to that, which is certainly fascinating, let's also talk about what drove you to decide to, was it Abiquiu that you ended up in?
Yes, the Abiquiu was the nearest town, but the cabin was actually about 5-10 miles outside of Abiquiu. It's near a place called Owl Mountain, and just the Red Rock Hills in New Mexico. It was pretty isolated. I just did a search online for writer's retreats and, you know, researched all types of different places I could kind of get away from my suburban lifestyle for a while and just retreat into nature the way Thoreau did, working on my book proposal, and Owl Mountain won out. So I think maybe it called to me because it was so similar to my childhood. You know, it was a log cabin. It was a single room like the log cabin I grew up in. It had solar panels. So I was monitoring my solar energy intake and, you know, propane stove. And it actually wasn't quite as rustic as the place I grew up in, but it was just really, you know, there was an outhouse, and it was just really a return to nature. And I fell in love with New Mexico. It was absolutely beautiful.
So what happened as you transitioned back into this this very singular, rustic connection with the earth?
Now, it was interesting because, you know, living here in our daily life, you know, we're bombarded with email, with things to do. And, you know, I got back there. I'm a single mom, so their dad took them for a couple weeks over Thanksgiving. And it was just really a joyful time going back to nature and being alone. You know, I remember some of my friends were like, don't get lonely. But, you know, for me, being alone is really, I really enjoy it. And, you know, you can be alone with your thoughts, and I could, you know, just contemplate the mountain. And really it helped me just focus on my writing. So it was really great. I was very happy during that time.
If you could name two stellar insights that may have developed, what might they be?
One of the things that, you know, I remember thinking as I went hiking up, and I was dangling my legs over a cliff there, over a ledge, and just thinking about, you know, just how beautiful the land was and what it must have been like, you know, when thousands of buffalo were there. And I, you know, I felt a little bit sad for what we've done to the earth, and I just, you know, prayed and hoped that people would start to wake up and realize that, you know, we really need to take care of the earth, and that it really is a, you know, precious resource. Mm-hmm. That was one of the things. And the other was just, you know, just with regard to my book, it really helped me bring the whole idea of, you know, what I was doing was to help bring truth to society, to our culture. I believe that intelligent design is something that is bringing people away from truth, both spiritual and, you know, material truths about the natural world. So it, you know, in writing the book, I hope to kind of open people's eyes and say, this is really what this is about. And, you know, there's no reason why evolution and Christianity have to conflict. they're not necessarily two different worldviews.
But most everybody understands the basic tenets of evolution, that is, that there is change through time based on natural selection, Darwin's theory, etc. And science has fairly well totally embraced that with variations and change. But intelligent design is a new creation. Why don't you give people a background on what that really means?
Basically, intelligent design, and I'll say at the outset, my background is in evolutionary biology. I wouldn't consider myself actually an expert in intelligent design because I think that intelligent design tries to be a scientific theory. It calls itself a theory when, in fact, very few, if any, scientific peer-reviewed publications have come out from intelligent design. I argued, that it's more of a political movement to try to oppose evolution. And so, essentially, intelligent design proponents are trying to look for the so-called fingerprints of a creator, of a designer in nature through various means. And there's a few key scientists that are promoting this through the Discovery Institute, which is based in Washington. So, but, where I'm coming at this book from is I am both a Christian and an evolutionary biologist. They don't have to conflict. Now, intelligent design is this new, wedge that's trying to come in and say evolution is an enemy of Christianity. Well, that's not a new thing from the church, but it's sort of a flare-up. Intelligent design is actually not new. It actually started back with William Paley over 100 years ago. But it was discredited as evolution became scientifically acceptable. But some people that started the Discovery Institute decided, well, really, I want to, take this concept, coin the term intelligent design, and promote it through, basically, they built a think tank, they got a lot of support, and it seems to me it's just snowballing, and to me it's a little bit scary. I taught biology for a few years, and my students, I would ask them at the beginning of the semester, what do you think evolution means? And they would say, it means that humans evolved from apes. You said most people understand evolution. There's a famous quote that says everyone thinks they understand evolution. But in reality, I don't think a lot of people really do know what evolution says.
I think that's a really good point. That I think you're right, that a lot of people would say that evolution means that we evolved from apes. That's right, yeah.
And not only is that a misconception because there was a common ancestor, there's the evolution of all of life. It's not just humankind. And, in fact, that's what a lot of people are most opposed to. But evolution is so much more complex. So I would then teach the unit, and at the end of the semester, I would say, well, what do you think of evolution now? Do you think there's enough evidence to support it? Do you think, inevitably they would say, wow, it's a lot more complex than I thought. There really is quite a bit of evidence, fossil evidence, genetic code, developmental similarities between all vertebrates, skeletal system similarities, and they would, some of them still would say, well, I still don't want to believe it. But the point was they would still do well on the test, they would understand the concepts, and that came down to they understood that evolution is a lot more complex than is being represented or than they may hear from their pastors or their parents or the public. So I think one of the things I want to do in my book is just say, okay, evolution 101, this is the basics of evolution. In a chapter, and it's a lot more complex than just people evolved from apes. That's not even what it says. And then here's intelligent design 101. And then I'm going to address what is truth. And we have scientific truth, and we have spiritual truth, and they're different realms.
Tell us some of the tenets, the scientific tenets of intelligent design.
There are some books out there that go point by point of why intelligent design is not science. That's not really what I am going to address. To me, I'm more interested in these are the basics of intelligent design, and I'm just at the outset of, I've been involved with, these issues in supporting evolution education. But what I know is that evolution is a scientific consensus, and intelligent design is not. It is something that was started by a fringe group of people that they say that this is a scientific theory, which is ironic that they call it a theory because it's just starting out, and so really it's a hypothesis. Until it's been tested and studied, and they have some peer-reviewed scientific publications behind them, then it's really nothing more than just a fringe idea. What they've done, though, is they've taken their, what they call a scientific concept, and they've politicized it by pushing it in the media and in the churches, and they've gotten people to think that, well, let's teach this as science, let's teach the controversy, but science is not a democracy. You can't vote gravity in or out of existence. You can't decide what you want to teach as science. So all I'm arguing in this book is that intelligent design is not science. It's a more of a religious concept. It's something, and you're right about the age of the Earth. There are some young Earth creationists that believe that the Earth was less, you know, between 6 and 10,000 years old. Most intelligent design proponents accept that the Earth is far more ancient than that. Some of them accept change within species. So, in effect, some intelligent design proponents, as I understand it, accept natural selection. They just don't accept macroevolution, the evolution of novel features such as limbs. So, you know, it's funny that you say, well, what are the concepts that intelligent design want, you know, scientifically are saying? And really, it's so mixed. It's, you know, what I call propaganda, because they're taking something, calling it science, but they're really trying to push more of a religious concept. And they're trying, you know, scientists don't take their ideas and promote them and do a public relations or marketing campaign to get them accepted or taught.
I know that some of my exposure to intelligent design concepts, it's almost as if the scientific proof is that the complexity of nature is unexplainable through evolution, and therefore it proves that there must have been an intelligence behind the design. I don't know if you can prove science by saying something is impossible, because impossibilities have been proven possible throughout all of science for a long time.
Right, sort of the God of the gaps.
That's exactly right. You also, besides being an evolutionary biologist and a wildlife ecologist and working on your PhD, as well are a practicing Christian. One of your efforts in writing the book is to indicate that these two concepts really shouldn't be at war, that as a matter of fact, there's much that can bring them together. Help us understand that.
It's interesting. I didn't exactly grow up in a religious household, but I did actually accept, you know, Jesus Christ at a very young age. I remember praying. In college, I learned about evolution as I became, you know, studied to earn my degree in wildlife ecology. And it is a beautiful theory. I absolutely, you know, was fascinated with it and, you know, came to my faith later. And I'm very glad that I wasn't burdened with this idea that evolution was some type of enemy of faith. And so when I came to my faith, it was sort of a non-issue. I never really bothered me, and when I read the Bible later, like I said, I believe I accepted Christ when I was a child, came away from the faith and came back to it about 10 years ago. So when I started reading Genesis, I mean, I remember thinking before I actually read it that it was, you know, very hypocritical, and I'd read it and I would be like, oh, this is a bunch of garbage. But I read it and I was actually quite amazed that, you know, it didn't say anything that I thought was too outlandish. I think it's actually quite remarkable that the order of the creation account roughly follows what we know about evolution. I think it's interesting that Adam was formed from the dust of the earth, and in fact, that's what evolution, you know, the origin of life, ultimately we came from organic, from non-organic matter, and amino acids were then formed, which formed DNA. So if you think of it, there's actually a number of different ways that evolutionary biologists that are Christians, and there are quite a few of them, reconcile the faith. And I think ultimately we have to have some humility, because there's a lot of mysteries that we will never know, you know, this side of heaven with absolute certainty what the answer is. And so we have to say, well, this is the best that science can do. This is the way we understand the world. This is what the Genesis account says. And it, you know, it does not affect my faith.
So how does this then play out in terms of the debate? If you were to address intelligent design advocates as well as, let's say, in a church setting, how would you make your case?
Well, I think the most important thing is that people understand what science is and that it's testing truths in the material or natural world. Now, there's natural and there's supernatural. There's physical and there's metaphysical. And spiritual truths are in a different realm. And that's not to say there's not some evidence of faith working in our life, but science, you know, Stephen Jay Gould likes to call them non-overlapping magisteria. There's the realm of science, and it tests things in the natural world by definition. And then there's spiritual truths, and there's faith, and that is simply a different realm of existence. You can't, and I believe this is where intelligent design fails as a faith-based concept, and that is that they're trying to test with science for God. And to me, it's almost, you know, arrogant. You know, why doesn't that negate faith? Why should we test for God? Do we need evidence of God? Isn't that what faith is all about?
I am a biologist myself, and I went through a very similar type of experience as you. It's a sort of a linear correlation in the sense that by the time I got to college, although I had been raised in a Christian faith, I too began to be quite an agnostic, and I don't know that I was an atheist per se, but I certainly began to suggest, I can recall making a commentary that I just didn't believe that there was some sort of gaseous vertebrate, otherwise known as God, hanging out somewhere in the heavens who administered everything. And that was my belief, and I don't even know how I would respond to that similar type of concept now. But there is something about science, and there is something about studying biology, that does tend to bring one away from a belief in God, and perhaps that's part of the challenge, is that those within the Christian faith are afraid that although they raise their children as Christians, that the process of discussing evolution may bring them away from that.
Actually, I think this is really interesting because I think that Scott Peck, author of the best-selling The Road Less Traveled, I think he's probably my favorite author, one of the most brilliant people I know of. And I think he explains this culture war to a T, and in fact, I'm going to address some of this in my book. And he talks about how there's four different stages of spiritual growth. And in the second stage, people, it's sort of an institutional stage where people like the status quo and rules. And, you know, I think that there are some religious people that have, that, you know, are sort of in a, you know, with all due respect, they like, you know, their faith is handed down to them. And then when people start to question, and what Peck says is that he didn't understand it because people would come to him in therapy, and if they were Christian, they would become atheists. And if they're atheists, they would become of some sort of faith. And he didn't understand it until he understood that what was happening was the people that were very religious, that were stuck in sort of a rule-based way of thinking, then started questioning. And a lot of these people, you know, the stage three is what he calls the materialistic. And these are scientists, not all scientists, there are some scientists who accept faith, but a lot of humanists are in this stage, and they're actually more, according to Peck, more spiritually advanced than certain people that are in the stage two institutional. And then there's the stage four, in which this group of people, we call them mystical, accept both the scientific worldview and the spiritual worldview, and they're comfortable with paradox. And so people that maybe didn't have a faith at that point, or really they put their faith in science and what they could see about the natural world, then started to see, well, wow, maybe there is actually a different realm. Maybe there is some sort of spiritual realm as well as what we can study about the natural world. So I think that that's very interesting. So I think you see these warring factions between religion and science, when some of the scientists are actually, in an ironic sense, spiritually more mature than, or spiritually more developed than some of the people that are stuck in the, this is the way it has to be, we have to think. You know, and one of the things he says is that people will go to great lengths to fight against this thing that they don't understand, and this is true both in individual psychotherapy and, you know, in our culture, that people ultimately expend more effort fighting against a new reality than it would take to actually incorporate that new reality into their understanding of the world.
There's more to be said about this debate. We continue with Wendy Holtkamp following this short break, just long enough to refill the Java. Then it's back with more of your Voice of the Earth here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
So which way will this debate develop? It's not going away anytime soon. Take a moment to think about your friends. Do they believe in evolution? Do they believe in God? Are the two compatible? Can you appreciate science and still hold on to your faith? We continue our discussion about evolution versus intelligent design when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News. We continue our discussion with Wendy Holtkamp, evolutionary biologist and Christian, as she pens the thoughts for her new book that addresses what she terms the fish wars. I believe most of the intelligent design war is coming from a fairly fundamentalist Christian perspective as opposed to other less fundamentalist churches. Am I right about that?
Yeah, it seems to be that, well, the ironic thing is a lot of people within, you know, the people that are really pushing intelligent design will say that it's not a Christian movement. They'll say, you know, we don't even name the designer as God. And that's actually, to me, it's sort of misleading because when you look at the individuals, they, you know, there was a great article in the New York Times recently, and I think the Baylor president, a Baylor University president said something like, you know, they won't claim that the designer is God, but we all know it's God. So they try to actually distance themselves from Christianity at all, but in reality we know that that's kind of misleading, and that's also part of what I'm going to talk about in my book. Why are they, you know, misleading about some of these things? But yeah, I think in general, I mean, I don't like too much to put labels on people, even though I just categorize everyone into the point. But, you know, I attend a Lutheran church, and I wouldn't say it's fundamental at all, but I will say, you know, I agree with the tenets of the faith completely, but there are, you know, my pastor accepts intelligent design, and I think that a growing number of people in non-fundamentalist churches are accepting this because, you know, James Dobson has Philip Johnson on his show, and it's becoming mainstream when, like I said earlier, most people really don't understand what evolution says and why it's not necessarily an enemy of Christianity or of faith, and why intelligent design is not necessarily science. It's not, you know, and it's not really a great faith-based concept either.
The ultimate bottom line on this is that the intelligent design advocates are insisting and actually legalizing the requirement that these concepts be introduced in science classes.
Right, and yeah, to me, frankly, that's pretty scary. When you're taking a concept that's never been published and you're trying to introduce it into the classroom, because you can't vote science in and out of existence. What's right is not always popular, and what's popular is not always right.
How would you place within the school setting, because this really has to do primarily with public schools, it is the public school sector, because in the private schools, people can teach whatever they want, more or less. But in the public schools, how would you place the interests of intelligent design in that matrix? Where does it belong, you feel, more properly?
I don't want to say it should be taught at all, frankly, but if there's a religion class or if there's a culture class, then these things can be discussed. It definitely does not belong in a science classroom.
I suppose what we need to ask next is, what do you see as the future of this debate? Because it is, in many respects, gaining quite a bit of momentum to the extent that in certain states it's been legislated as a requirement for classes. Where is this headed?
What I think is really important is that every person critically analyze their beliefs. And they think about not only what do I believe, but what beliefs did I inherit from my parents, from the culture I was born in, and are these, you know, what I read about in the media, is this true information? That what I'm going to close my book with is actually some tools so that people can figure out how do they analyze the reliability of information. If I hear something from an expert, how do I know that that expert is really an expert, or how do I know that that study was really funded by, you know, wasn't necessarily funded by some organization that maybe would make the results questionable. So I think it's just really important that people understand what science is and that it's different from the spiritual realm, and also just how to judge the reliability of information. I think as a writer and as a journalist, I talk to journalists on, you know, different lists, and I teach nature writing, and, you know, I just try to tell them, you know, our job is so important. The majority of the public learns about science from the media. And so what we write about, whether it's in the New York Times or in a magazine or on the web, you know, we really have to be careful of what we say. Scientists are very humble about their work, but sometimes when you interview a scientist, a journalist will edit out some of those words, like maybe, it seems like, that scientists like to use those words. And so in the media, it comes across like this is the end-all and be-all answer. But I think that the public really would do well to really try to understand science and the way it works and the difference between the result of a single scientific study versus a scientist's body of work versus a scientific consensus. Like evolution is a scientific consensus. It's not a single study. It's thousands upon thousands of studies over, you know, hundreds of years or a couple of hundred years. So I think that's where I would like the future of this debate to go, is that the citizens of this country and of the world need to really be educated in the way science works.
I guess there isn't going to be any simple answer on this one. I think it's going to be decided in the realms of politics, unfortunately. You do see a political side to all of this. What's your spin on that?
That's a good question. I don't think that science should be politicized. I think that what is taught in the schools should be what the science actually is, you know, revealing at that moment.
My mission is very similar to yours, I suppose, in some respects, in that I am trying to integrate science and religion to get people comfortable with this. Because from my perspective as a scientist, mm-hmm. I just do see a spiritual side to nature. I'm crying out for the wonder. I look at this earth and it is a miraculous reality. I don't know how it came to be. I can speculate in a thousand different ways. But the truth is, as a scientist, it's absolutely miraculous. It's actually, I'm kind of working the other way. I'm trying to bring this acknowledgement that there's something more to life mm-hmm. than a lot of scientists are prepared to talk about or discuss. I mean, it's very common to go into situations with even environmental issues where if you start as talking about the animals and their right to be, or that they have their own sense of reality or feelings, there's a lot of scientists and hardcore scientists in the room who are going to start rolling their eyes around and go, oh my God, okay, it's one of those guys again, you know? And that's killing us to a large extent. That's killing the mission that I have, which is to try to really bring greater value and meaning and significance to the living realms that some scientists just, you know, if it's strictly science, and there's a lot of powerful scientists out there who see it that way, it's difficult to assign greater value to living things than that they're just, they happen to be a self-energizing, miraculous sort of machine, you know.
And I think actually that's one thing I'd like to add, is that the intelligent design debate is really harming faith and Christianity a lot more than it's doing any good, because I think a lot of scientists who know that evolution is a fact, they look at some, you know, the Christians that are saying, you know, you have to accept intelligent design or you can't accept evolution and have faith in there, they think that it's ridiculous. So, you know, I think in the long run that when the church can get behind the fact that sound science and faith do not have to conflict, real sound science, not a pseudoscience that pretends to be a science. You know, when scientists can see that people of faith can actually embrace the reality of what science shows about the world, then they'll say, wait a minute, so maybe that's not quite so wacky after all. Maybe there is something to that, because I think you're right. I think most people, not everybody, but, you know, I think it's something like 90% of Americans accept some sort of universal spirit or believe in God, and I think it's 45% of scientists. So I think if we can get to the point where the church accepts that science and faith do not have to conflict, because actually it's the scientists already understand that for the most part. It's a lot of people within the church that don't quite get that. If we can get them, then maybe the scientists will say, maybe that is not so strange after all. There is a lot of wonder in the natural world.
One of the things that has frustrated me, just from the perspective of religions and churches, and we'll say in America, is that to some extent they've allied themselves with forces and powers and politics that tend to really abuse the gift, exploitation of forests, and allied with politics that don't want to enforce air standards or water standards or to really embrace the science, for example, that says that global warming is a reality and ultimately could lead to the devastation of whole ecosystems and therefore animals, which are supposed to be part of God's creation. So I find a conflict there internally within some of the faiths that I'm hoping to be able to help to resolve through these types of discussions, to say that actually science serves the faith community in their responsibility to take care of God's creation. If you see it as the gift of God to humankind, then there is also a responsibility to care for that creation. And this debate, which negates science almost and sort of attacks it in some respects, really tends to defeat their spiritual responsibility.
Yeah, absolutely. There's the whole creation care or stewardship. There's an increasing awareness that we were given the role of stewards over the earth, and that's not, you know, in contrast to some of the way that people have responded historically to, you know, divide and conquer the earth, that's really not what our responsibility is as stewards of the earth, that we do have a responsibility to care for God's creation and in a sense maybe recreate the Garden of Eden to keep the earth as beautiful and as we can. You know, we are part of the ecology of the earth as well, but we have a responsibility to the animals and the creatures that can't protect themselves because we're destroying their habitat.
I appreciate you bringing up creation care, because that actually is a movement as well within the Christian community. We'll say the religious community, because it is not just Christian. I might encourage anyone who is puzzled or thinking about this debate to give creation care and that movement as well a really serious look, because I really feel that it shows a wonderful responsibility towards this earth from the faith community that I fully embrace.
Yeah, absolutely. But there's quite a bit of writing out there too, just some incredible nature writing about simplifying your life, which comes back to, you know, what I was doing out in New Mexico, just living close to the earth and having a very simple lifestyle and reducing our energy consumption and those type of things are just really a responsible way to live and something that I'm trying to bring back. You know, as I mentioned in an essay that I wrote that you first read in E! Magazine, just about going back to nature and now returning back to my suburban lifestyle, thinking, well, I need to bring some of that here. I need to start, you know, thinking about my lifestyle again and how I can incorporate more of those concepts into my life here in the city.
We've been talking with Wendy Holtkamp, who is joining us from Houston. Wendy, if people want to learn a lot more about what you're doing and what you've done in the past, what's the best way to do so?
I have a website. It's wendyholtkamp.com. And that is Wendy, W-E-N-D-E-E, Holtkamp, H-O-L-T-C-A-M-P.com.
And as well as a writer, you teach writing?
Yes.
And how do you do that?
I teach an online nature writing course. It's a course about how to write about nature and the environment. I focus on if there's a lot of scientists that take my class and there's writers that just want to break more into outdoor and nature and environment markets. So it's targeted for both aspiring and professional writers.
Now, you also suggested that the class is filled somehow?
I'm getting close to capacity.
That's interesting. It's very personal then as well. You must work personally with your students.
Oh, yeah. I give all the students a lot of feedback on their writing and on targeting the right markets. We do studies of, you know, their dream market and how they can break in. And I have provide information, Q&As with editors from major national magazines. And so it's a very intensive class. I like to give people a lot of personal interaction. So.
And then as well, you're a photographer.
Yes, I've been doing photography. I'd say it's more of a hobby. I have published my photos, but writing is more my profession.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you for a very articulate and well-thought-out discussion of this controversy that seems to be in the news every couple of days now. Wendy Holtkamp, thanks for adding your voice to the Wild Side News.
Thank you. It's been an honor to be here.
There's no doubt that nature holds the truth for all to see. And it's no secret that all the great religions are inspired by a God they see revealed in its beauty and transcendence. Yes, it is a mystery. And if you want to take a better look, stick around for our next segment as we head to far north country and a local nature study organization that just may be a place for you when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News. Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith. Looking for a great retreat so that you can get your fingers poking around in a forest of discovery or hear the call of a warbler echoing through the understory of a tall pine forest and maybe even add some credits to a graduate degree or get one of your own? The North Cascades Institute, tucked up not far from the Canadian border in Washington State, has a lot to offer. So many of my listeners are nature advocates. That's what we do. We live it, we love it, and many of us are very concerned and are trying to make sure that we do what we can to preserve a sustainable future on this planet. And sometimes we wonder, gosh, how are we going to do that? And one of the best ways to figure out how to get there faster is to talk with people who have knowledge and who can share that. In other words, learn. So we're going to take a trip up to Cedro Woolley, Washington, a place I've never heard of before. There's a very interesting nature learning center that has been around for quite some time, and we're talking with Saul Weisberg, who is the executive director of the North Cascades Institute. Saul, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Well, thanks for having me.
The North Cascades Institute is a multifaceted nature education, well, I'm going to call it an operation because it has many different aspects. First of all, give us kind of an overview, and then we're going to also talk about a new educational facility that you have in partnership with the National Parks and Forest Service and Seattle and Huxley College. First of all, give a little history about the North Cascades Institute.
Well, we started just almost 20 years ago, and we're a nonprofit educational organization. We're a conservation organization. Our mission is to conserve and restore Northwest environments through education. So everything we do is education, but if we're successful, we expect to see changes on the ground. So we don't just, you know, see how many people we reach, but we see what those people are actually going to do, and our goal is to get them engaged in their own communities in environmental decision-making and learning more about the world around them. And we work with, as you said, a really wide range of people. We have programs in the schools for at elementary school level. We have residential camping-based programs for elementary, middle, and high school students. We have we're in the fourth year of a new graduate program offering a master's in environmental education. We do many seminars and workshops for teachers and interested folks in the public on, you know, specialized topics, whether it's dragonfly identification or geology or nature photography. And then a lot of sort of conferences and specialized things around that, as well as this as a new facility, a new center in North Cascades National Park, which is giving us the opportunity to reach a whole new audience.
This has been in process for about 20 years, and I believe that you actually were involved from the beginning.
You know, this started, there was a group of us who were living and working in the Northwest. I was working as a backcountry climbing ranger for North Cascades National Park. I had some friends who were working as interpreters, some working for the Forest Service, firefighters. And we found that, we've been doing this for a number of years, and we found that come late fall, September, October, we were leaving for different parts of the country to work in nature centers or environmental education centers because there wasn't anything like this in Washington State. And we had come out of a climbing trip in the Picket Range, and we were sitting by Ross Lake, and we said, you know, this is crazy. This is home. This is the place we love. Let's start a school. And not knowing anything about that, knowing nothing, literally nothing about that, we went ahead with it. And it was good we didn't know much about the business side of that because we probably wouldn't have started. But we did know that we knew the place really well. We knew the stories. We knew how to teach. We knew the wilderness. And so that was sort of the genesis of it. And over the years, it's grown from, you know, two of us working part-time, doing primarily seminars on natural history, field seminars on natural history, to now we have, I think we just hired our 25th staff member, and we have year-round programs for a wide range of audience, and it's still fun.
Now, where is this? Give people a visual of where they can find the North Cascades Institute.
Okay. Well, our offices are in a building we share with the National Park Service, Forest Service, U.S. Geological Service in Cedar Woolley, which is a little town about an hour south of the Canadian border on the west side of the Cascades, very close to the northern part of Puget Sound. And our new facility, the North Cascades Environmental Learning Center, is about an hour, hour and a half east of us up in the mountains. Sits on the north shore of Diablo Lake, right below Sourdough Mountain, which is the mountain where the fire lookout Gary Snyder was back in the 50s. We are on a beautiful mountain lake with 8,000 to 9,000 foot glacier-covered peaks right across the way. So that's a spectacular place. That's where I wish I was today.
By the way, people who are visiting the website are able to see some of those images, and it is spectacular. It's really a divine space up there. It's transcendental in so many ways. Gorgeous, gorgeous setting.
Thanks. Yeah, it's, I mean, that's why we're here, because of the place. I don't think, you know, I ever said I want to be an executive director. I did say, you know, I love this place. How do we work to make it, just to keep it safe?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that's interesting about this part of the world is that the center sits in North Cascades National Park, but if you start looking at all the surrounding wilderness lands, national forest lands, and then cross the border into British Columbia, we sit in the middle of about 7 million acres of protected public lands, and it's the largest chunk of protected lands along the U.S.-Canada border. And the protection, of course, is very, very wide variety. I mean, it ranges from Park Service wilderness to land in British Columbia that's still accessible to logging and mining, but also has protected status, so it's available for recreation and education as well. So it's a really, it's a special spot, and being able to have a facility along one of the few roads that cuts across the North Cascades is a way to get other, you know, enable other people to get here and enjoy it and learn from it too.
One of the things I think I find very intriguing about the North Cascades Institute is the fact that you really have such an incredible diversity of programming, everything from obviously for school kids and teachers,
mm-hmm.
Families, family getaways. You also have summer youth adventures. And we're going to talk about your master's in education graduate program and as well as seminars. I guess because I've been in this business, I call it a business, it's the nature business,
mm-hmm.
for quite some time. I'd be curious, since you've been involved in this for over 20 years, what types of changes have you noticed in how people come to this experience?
Ooh, good question. You know, I think part of it, what I've seen is sort of the changes that I've seen in my own life, which is, you know, 20 years ago, climbing ranger, you know, I had a new baby, recently married, and so getting out in the backcountry for long periods of time was relatively easy. You know, wasn't worried that much about, money. You know, getting out was the main thing, and being very politically active about it was very important to me. And I think one of the changes I've seen is that it's both become, you know, it's easier in some ways, and it's harder. And I think the thing I've seen with the public at large is just there's less time. I see much less ability of folks to get out into wild places, into, you know, real, more primal nature. It's really difficult for people to do because of how busy everyone is. And certainly as you age and, you know, end up with families and jobs that require you to be a certain place at a certain time, that gets tougher. So what I've seen is folks interested in shorter programs, you know, less two-week programs, but more, you know, 3 and 4 day programs, weekend programs. And one of the reasons we started our graduate program was because we really felt things were missing when you did things for short. So now we have this almost 2-year-long program that is more of an immersion.
20 years ago, a lot of this was very new. People didn't have a knowledge base. They came at this and all talking about niches and diversity and habitats and things was sort of new. It's my belief that people come to these experiences quite informed.
You know, I think you're right. I think the level of ecological literacy is much higher. But I also think that it's still kind of narrow. We were just having a meeting with some folks, and one of them just said, we were talking about education and management being sort of more watershed-based rather than just political boundaries, administrative boundaries. And someone who'd been working in, you know, new resource management to some extent raised their hand and said, you know, what's a watershed? And so I'm always surprised by some of the things that we take for granted that the general public may not understand. So I think it's important when we say habitat or niche or ecosystem that we define it to some level so that we know we're not losing people because we know the jargon and they don't.
Give us an idea, if someone were to be in your area and heard about this and said, geez, I'd like to stop by and see what's going on, what might they be able to learn? What kind of programming or information?
Mm-hmm. Part of it depends on the season. If it's in the spring and summer, we have a wide range, about, I think, 60 to 70 field seminars that range from programs that are for family getaways to programs that might focus on butterflies as ecological indicators or nature photography or going out and learning how to identify amphibians in the mountains. So there's things, very specific things like that. If they're affiliated with the school, we do programs with the school. So there's some programs where we go into the classroom and work with teachers in their classes. There's some programs where we bring students and teachers and parents out into the field where they go and they collect data, where they learn about plant identification. Then they go back into the classroom and figure out what do we do with this information? How do we make it useful to us as we're part of a community that has to make decisions?
I'm curious what happens on a family getaway. What can a family expect if they participate in one of North Cascade Institute's family getaways?
A lot of fun. Being in a really cool place and being surrounded by people who know it really well. So our goal with family getaways was to, rather than having folks, you know, go on a vacation somewhere or go to a resort and sort of nature is the backdrop, we wanted to bring the nature into the forefront. So we have programs going on throughout the day that people can or decide not to attend. And we have programs that work for a family, or just the adults in the family, or just the kids. So the kids might be out in the field doing some tracking, and some of the adults might be on a long day hike, and maybe mom and a daughter might be out canoeing in one of our canoe programs. So these things are going on throughout the day, and so they're really full, but we try to allow time for the families to get together and hang out as well. And those are all based at our new learning center in North Cascades National Park, so the surroundings are, you know, it's an incredible place to to be.
So it's actually a lodge. I mean, they get a chance to stay in a room and have meals served and things of that nature?
Yeah, the new Learning Center is it's an amazing facility. We just opened it this past July. It was built in partnership with the National Park Service and with the City of Seattle. And it is, it's like a lodge. We have double rooms and amazing dining hall, amazing chef, and we also have classrooms and aquatic and terrestrial labs and a wonderful library and trails that lead right from the Learning Center, as well as all the trails in the national park that are readily accessible. And so it's a place to come and be in the middle of a wild place, but be able to learn about it instead of just seeing it as, you know, scenery.
How is that priced out? What would they expect to invest in their learning?
It varies by the length of the program. We have programs this coming year that are 3, 4, and 5 days. The family programs vary in cost, but usually they range about just under $300 for the couple, and then about a little under $100 for additional people. Mm-hmm. And so it really depends on, you know, children are much less expensive, obviously. So if you are coming with a big family, it's a better deal. But we have a really large scholarship program as well, and our goal is to not turn people away because they can't afford to pay. So we do budget a lot of money for scholarships and financial assistance as well.
And then if people wanted to learn about the family getaway specifically, what's the best way for them to find out more about that?
The easiest way right now is to go to our website, which is www.ncascades.org. On the website, or they could give us a call, but either way, they can get on our mailing list for announcements of the different programs as they come up and get our catalog, which will be out probably in early February.
One of the things I find very exciting is the fact that you're offering a graduate degree program mm-hmm. in nature education, environmental education, and various permutations. That's exciting. Tell us, first of all, about the program.
Sure. The program grew out of, we had a really successful undergraduate internship program. Folks really wanted to learn what we were doing and coming and working with us. And we saw over time that we were getting less and less undergraduates and more folks who had already graduated from college but really wanted this kind of experience and kind of real pragmatic experience and things that would help them get jobs. And so the graduate program grew out of that, and it's a 7-quarter program. It's a partnership with Huxley College of the Environment, which is part of Western Washington University in Bellingham, Washington. And the program begins in June. The students, we take up to a dozen students each year. They begin with a really kind of immersion in the backcountry of the North Cascades. So they're studying. They have a few long trips in the wilderness. They do a lot of talking with resource management people, National Park and Forest Service people, and they're studying the natural and cultural history of the region, land management, the ecology of this part of the Pacific Northwest. And after that sort of deep summer experience, they are then in residence with North Cascades Institute and our Learning Center for 4 quarters, where they work in and are taught in pretty much everything we do. So they're involved in teaching in youth programs, in designing and teaching adult programs. They're involved in budget planning. They learn about grant writing and fundraising. They work with us in marketing programs. They work with us in establishing partnerships with school districts or others. And then after that year, they spend the final 2 quarters at Western Washington University completing some other additional academic requirements. And they end up with a master's degree in environmental education and certification from the Institute in Leadership and Nonprofit Administration.
Now, you say you have 12 students per year?
Yes.
And what's the status for this upcoming year?
Well, we accept students. They begin in mid-June, and we're accepting applications now. I believe we have space available for the upcoming class. We begin reviewing applications soon after the first of the year. So this would be a good time if people are interested to give us a call or check the website to find out more, and you can download all the application materials and see what past and present students are doing and where they're working now and that kind of information.
That's really interesting because I'm an old Nature Center guy myself, and this really prepares people very specifically to get very involved at an administrative level and executive level and as well field levels in nature centers. And what other applications do you find your graduates working in?
Yeah, you know what drove this initially is we saw lots of people coming in to work with us who are really talented, really passionate field naturalists. And they loved this work, and they were working with kids, or they were working with adults, and they were great. And after 3 or 4 or 5 years, they'd get older, they'd want things like, start a family, buy a home, and they just didn't see a way that this profession would support that long term. There just weren't that many opportunities. And at the same time, we need a lot more organizations like ours doing this kind of work. So one of the goals of the program is that I believe that when students finish this, they could go out and start a North Cascades Institute. They have the skills to do that, certainly way more than we had when we started, in terms of not just programming and the content of nature interpretation and education, but also in the, how to read a budget, how to write a grant. And we see our students going into a whole variety of different areas, some working for the agencies, the land management agencies. We have students working for a wide variety of nonprofits, some of them as science directors, some of them doing development work, fundraising and marketing work. We have two successful, young but successful nonprofits that have been started by our graduate students. So it's pretty wide right now, but I'm enthusiastic about seeing them move into positions at a higher level. It's when we're hiring, we often, it's sort of, we can get many people who can do the basic part of the job, but who gives us that added value, who can do more, who can have great synergy with our other staff and develop new things? And I see that's what our graduate students can really do well, is they think big, but they can also really handle it, the pragmatic parts of it.
It almost sounds like you ought to set up a franchise program.
No.
To some extent, from my perspective, I'm always promoting the concept that good work should become profitable.
Yeah.
Because then people will do good work. And you're kind of helping to manifest that a person can go through this course. And as you say, many people who came into these kinds of programs in the past would live in little shacks and they'd be happy to get $200 a month and a place to bunk, mm-hmm. As staff. But that doesn't cut it after a while, as you say.
Right, yeah. And I say no. I'd love our program to grow, and it's growing well. But one of the things I think that makes the North Cascades Institute the experience powerful is that we really focus on intimate experiences in a particular place. And there are some other great programs around the country that offer master's programs in environmental education that have a residency component. They may not offer the degree, but they offer the residency. And there's an excellent one at the Teton Science School, and there's others around the country that do this very similar. Teton's actually been doing it much longer than we have.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all the programs are a little bit different. What's great about them is they're all focused in a specific place, and you learn about that place as well as about the other techniques and abilities.
Well, that's critical to keep it real and meaningful. Absolutely,
yeah.
I totally agree. In the short term here, what sort of winter programs are you offering?
We're offering a number of winter programs that have to do we're doing one that's coming up really soon on the bald eagles of the Skagit River Basin. This is one of the... We get 600 to 800 bald eagles wintering here every year, and it's a huge part of our local ecosystem because they're dependent upon the salmon runs and the Skagit River, which is the river that flows by the Learning Center and down through the valley here, is the largest river entering Puget Sound, and it still has healthy runs of all the native salmon species. So the interaction between people and the way they use fish and clean water and clean air and the eagles and all of that, it's a great story to bring all this together. So we have a number of adult, primarily adult programs going through the winter, and right now we're in our final planning mode for next year's graduate program, next year's programs with the schools. We're also recruiting schools right now to come to the Environmental Learning Center next year, both in the spring and the fall. And so we're working with local public schools, but also casting our net wider than we have in the past through the greater Seattle area and south to Tacoma. This could be, we do have schools coming from all over the country. Our primary focus is on the Pacific Northwest, though.
Well, at some point I'm going to make my way up to the North Cascades Institute and meet you and your staff and see what you're doing. Maybe we can do a program from there. I think it'd be very interesting.
That would be great. It'd be, we're delighted to show this place off to people and have them get involved.
One thing I might mention, too, and people can see this on the website and when they visit your website, that it is the new facility is absolutely beautiful. It's architecturally, it's just a very appealing place.
Yeah, one of the great challenges but also the great contributions that our partners made to this process is that because this is on national park land and funded in large part by the city of Seattle as partial mitigation for the hydroelectric dams they have on the Skagit River, which supply power to the city, it had to be silver certified for LEED, the Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. And the architecture was really, we worked with a wonderful local architect. So the place works really well. It's almost all certified, sustainably harvested wood, lots of rock from on-site. The floors are from recycled old maple, recycled gym floors. But it's beautiful. It's a beautiful place. It works really well. You know, you're always nervous when you're working on something like this to see that when you're done, if it really functions the way you'd hoped. And we're really pleased. And I never, when I was in graduate school, I never had a little cabin that looked out across a mountain lake at 8,000-foot peaks. And, I'll go back and do it again.
Well, I encourage everybody who has an opportunity to get up and visit with the North Cascades Institute, get involved in some of the programming, and if you feel so inclined, look into their graduate program. Saul Weisberg, Executive Director of the North Cascades Institute, I want to thank you for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Nature people, unite. Take back the wonder. Treat it like the gift it is, from wherever it came from. Tell your friends to come along as we meet each week to share our wills for peace to all the living beings. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet next Thursday or any time on the archives when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wild Side News.